Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Let's talk pay today. How much we make, who gets to decide how much we make, and how we talk about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams. It's Thursday, the 4th of July. Good to have you with us on this national holiday. With July in full swing, it's the height of performance review season, that wonderful time of year when employees fill out self-assessments, set their goals, and angle for a raise. We recently wrapped up our 8th Marketplace Edison research poll, and we asked workers about broaching the taboo subject of salaries with their coworkers. Only about a quarter of respondents said they had, though the practice was more common among workers under 35 and slightly more common among women. From our workplace culture desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on the potential benefits and pitfalls of opening up about your paycheck.
23-year-old Stephen Redding has run into opposition when he's tried to get details about how much some of his engineering colleagues make on the offshore oil rigs where he works.
I've never, went up and, premeditated asking somebody. It's kind of frowned upon.
He's happy to volunteer his own among close colleagues and finds the information helpful.
Kind of my logic is if somebody's making more and they're the same age in the same position, I want to know why they're making more, because they might have done something, they might have some other experience, got them to that position, and I could use it to advance my career.
Writer and illustrator Susie Cagle has been radically open about her pay. A few years ago, she published a newsletter detailing every dollar of freelance income she took in for a year, totaling about $39,000.
It got an interesting response, just, oh my God, you actually put all that information out there.
Since then, she says, the conversation around pay has really started to pick up, with Twitter hashtags like TalkPay encouraging people to post their numbers on social media or in public Google Docs. Increasingly, pay transparency is seen as key to achieving equity for women in racial and ethnic groups who still make less than their male and white counterparts.
Absent information about where you stand, you don't really have a good grounds on which to make a case that you are being underpaid. Or even in some cases discriminated against.
Emiliano Hewitt-Vaughn is an economist at UCLA who has studied pay transparency. He's found knowing what your colleagues make can also spur greater productivity by tapping into workers' competitive instincts. But that can also create conflict, says Karen Dillon, author of the Harvard Business Review Guide to Office Politics.
It can create rivalries where there were none. It can create resentments where there were none. I think it's a very tricky thing to navigate.
She says with more workers opening up about their pay, it's important employers have fair and clearly outlined criteria for pay grades and advancement before employees take their frustrations to backroom discussions. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
U.S. markets are closed today, but overseas there are still some trading fireworks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A fight to raise the minimum wage is happening at different levels of government. Over the past several years, many cities and towns passed ordinances to raise it. But in 25 states, those local governments are forbidden from setting a minimum wage that's higher than the state standard. That list includes Alabama, Florida, Iowa, Missouri, Kentucky, and Wisconsin, where state legislatures recently blocked local wage increases. There's now new information about just how big of an impact these policies are having on low-wage workers. Tracy Jan is a reporter for The Washington Post, and she's been covering this story. Welcome to the program, Tracy.
Thanks for having me, Kimberly.
So can you give me a sense of the scale of how often this happens?
So there are actually close to 350,000 workers who should have received pay raises and they work in low-wage jobs, but those pay raises were either never instituted or they were rescinded after the state legislatures passed laws to forbid local governments from passing minimum wage laws.
So I'm from St. Louis, and I'll take some hometown privilege here and ask you to use Missouri as an example, because this has happened there.
Absolutely. And Missouri actually is one of the most egregious cases of the six states that had rescinded or blocked local wage laws. In 2017, the St. Louis minimum wage was supposed to have risen to $10 an hour, which it did briefly. Shortly after the wage law went into effect, the state legislature put in another law to basically supersede local wage laws.
So what did that mean for low-wage workers in St. Louis?
That means tens of thousands of low-wage workers lost their raises. For a brief period, they were able to get $10 an hour, which is actually not even close to a living wage. And then those raises were, for the most part, rescinded. I was talking to Betty Douglas, who was a longtime McDonald's worker. She's 61 years old. She's worked at McDonald's for 13 years. For most of those 13 years, she was only making $7 an hour, or just over $7 an hour, until 2017, when this minimum wage increase went into effect for St. Louis. Her pay rose to $10. And fortunately for her, her manager did not rescind her raise because she, I guess, they recognized her long service. But she said many of her colleagues lost those, you know, $2 and some change raise, which makes a big difference when you're living paycheck to paycheck.
But there was really nothing they could do, right?
Correct. So for Missouri as a whole, last fall during the midterms, the state passed a ballot measure to raise the minimum wage statewide. But it's, you know, to raise it to $12 an hour by the year 2023. The woman I was talking to, Betty Douglas, she cares for her youngest son, her eldest son, who is recovering from a brain tumor, and her brother, who's disabled. So she's a family of four. And according to The Economist, you need to make $18.99 for a family of four to meet their basic needs.
Now, that's some of the reaction and obviously discontent from minimum wage workers in that example. But what about the businesses who have to pay those higher wages? What do they have to say about the local initiatives versus the state actions?
Yeah, I think businesses, for the most part, don't like these local laws because a lot of businesses have businesses in multi-states, multi-cities, and so they don't like the inconsistencies of it. Activists would say that, you know, Missouri has an overwhelmingly white legislature. St. Louis and Kansas City are predominantly minority, or at least in Kansas City is nearly half, and St. Louis is higher. And so there's a racial element to this, too. The staff attorney at the National Economic Law Project calls Missouri one of the most egregious examples of an overwhelmingly white legislature undoing the will of local minority communities.
So what happens next in Missouri and these other places where these rollbacks have happened?
There's a movement to get rid of some of these statewide laws. Local municipalities in some states are still trying to pass local wage increases. And Betty Douglas, the McDonald's worker, is still very much actively fighting for $15 an hour wage increase.
Tracy Jan covers the intersection of race and the economy for the Washington Post. Thanks for making time for us on the holiday.
Thank you very much.
While many people are enjoying a day off today for the 4th of July holiday, there are those with multiple jobs where a day off from one might be a day on for another. Case in point, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, one in six U.S. school teachers work second jobs, which means even though classes at public schools have ended for the summer, many teachers are still hard at work, including the educator in the latest installment of our ongoing series, My Economy.
My name is Megan Johnson, and I teach at Lansing High School in Lansing, Kansas. I just completed my third year of teaching, so I'm about to start my fourth. My summer plan is to work my second job at a bank. I work there about 5 days a week, and I actually work during the school year at the bank as well on weekends. I do get paid my teacher's salary over the summer, but I don't get my supplemental pay, so it's kind of just my base teacher pay because I do extracurriculars, like I'm the junior class sponsor, I'm the K-Ed sponsor, but I don't get that, so it's about $2,000 less a month. I have to have a second job to help support myself. One thing that I get tired of hearing is, oh, you have a 3-month vacation. And as a teacher, we really don't. All of my teacher friends, we've met up, we've been planning, we've been trying new things, we've been going to conferences, and they only give us 2 days at the beginning of the year to plan, and that's not enough time. So it's like I'm still doing teacher things while still working at the bank. I really hope one day I do not have to work at the bank. Mental health is a huge thing for me. And last year I really had like a breakdown, I want to say, where I was just so stressed out. I was just so worn down. This last year has really hit me where I was like, I need to take care of myself. I'm not being the best teacher because I'm mentally not happy. This summer, I have made it a point to do something new once a week. I want to try something new, and it can be something little, it can be something big, but I want to try something new once a week just for me. I have at least 2 days during the week off from the bank. I usually have Wednesday and Fridays off, and I know it's not the weekend, but it's this whatever to me. Like, I tried CrossFit for the very first time. That was my new experience last week. This week, we're gonna go play mini golf at the Arts Museum. So I'm just trying to find the little things that I can do and actually have a social life.
This series is all about you. Tell us about your economy at marketplace.org. Coming up?
Normally you would think if you own a car, it costs you a fortune, it costs you a lot of money.
Normally, but not on one island. But first, let's do the numbers. Here in the U.S., markets are closed for the Independence Day holiday. In Europe, Britain's FTSE slipped nearly 0.1%. France's CAC 40 was basically flat. Germany's DAX ticked up 0.1%. Speaking of Germany, today German automakers BMW and Daimler announced they are joining forces to develop self-driving or autonomous technology. Shares of BMW edged up 0.1%. Daimler shares were flat. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei climbed 0.3%. The Shanghai Composite Index tumbled 0.3%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index was off 0.2%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. A massive fire this week at a Jim Beam warehouse in Kentucky destroyed 45,000 barrels of whiskey. That's the equivalent of 6 million bottles of the bourbon. As Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, this is just the latest blow to the whiskey industry, which has had a rough couple of years.
Whiskey distilleries in the United States had been in a boom. Big brands like Jim Beam and Jack Daniel's, along with a couple thousand newer, smaller distillers, were enjoying high domestic profits and a growing market overseas to the tune of $1.2 billion annually. Then in mid-2018, things changed, says David Osgo, economist at the Distilled Spirits Council.
When the tariffs came along, it had a huge and immediate impact on them.
And unlike larger distillers with established distribution lines overseas, smaller distillers found it especially hard to sustain tariffs from China, Mexico, Canada, and a 25% tariff the European Union imposed on American whiskey.
Europe tends to sell in different bottle sizes, so they invested in bottle inventory that was just wasted immediately. In a lot of instances, they simply don't make as much product as they had planned.
Export sales plummeted. In the last 6 months of 2018, they went down more than 10%. They're still in decline, says Jonathan Doe, a business professor at Villanova University. And it may not be over yet. even for the larger distillers.
It could be that importers decide to begin to carry other kinds of products, maybe Canadian whiskey, for example, or maybe scotch.
Making whiskey isn't cheap, fast, or easy, says Matthew Slaughter, economics professor at Dartmouth College. So distillers have to make some tough decisions.
You could keep your U.S. price the same, but you know that the tax that's added on by the foreign government is going to mean fewer sales. Or you might decide to try to minimize or at least cushion the lost sales. You could cut your U.S. price that you are selling into that foreign market.
Either way, he says, they're incurring economic harm. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Marketplace has a new podcast out now called This Is Uncomfortable. It's a storytelling podcast about life and how money messes with it. Because talking about money, it's awkward, right? Pretty much with anyone. And especially with someone you've just started dating. Here's the host of This Is Uncomfortable, Rima Kreis, who brings us the story of one couple who avoided money conversations until they just couldn't anymore.
Nika Geiger and Terrence McPherson had been casually dating for a few months in Atlanta, but they didn't make their relationship official until they moved far away from each other and started business schools on opposite sides of the country.
While there were interesting people in business school, what we were seeing in business school just didn't beat what we already had. I woke up one morning and I was like, I just don't feel single anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, I technically am, and I technically have the ability to go on all these dates, but I just don't feel it. I'm ready to be all in. Let's do this thing.
And it's then, when they're thousands of miles apart and totally officially together, that money starts to creep into their relationship. Because Nika has this side of her life that Terrence doesn't know much about. She's deep in debt.
I don't think he knew amounts, but I think he knew at least that I had student loans from undergrad.
Yeah, she'd taken out $40,000 in loans for undergrad and took out even more for business school. And by winter, her money for the first semester is nearly gone.
I wasn't even going to be able to go home for Christmas that year. I was, like, watching what I eat. I was not buying anything new. You know, I'm feeling very, very broke. And Terrence would kind of joke about, man, but I'm broke right now. And I was like, sir, you have thousands of dollars in the bank. I get that you want to adopt the broke mindset, but when I say broke, we don't mean the same thing.
Terrence, he's got savings in the bank. He's got money coming in from renting his condo.
My level of broke was I may not be able to go with my classmates who decided they wanted to do a three-day weekend in Argentina and quote-unquote ball out with my friends.
I was like, okay, all right. My broke is $30 in the bank and, you know, I've got to fill up my tank and figure out food until I get this next paycheck.
It really made me pause and reflect on the words I've been using, the way that I've been expressing how much money I have. And I think a lot of it is because we as a culture don't talk about money as transparently as we should. And so I didn't want to broach those grounds. And so I just assumed.
It was one of the first conversations where we were honest about, you know, our financial states.
Well, sort of. Nika still didn't reveal just how much debt she's in.
At that point, I knew that when I graduated from business school, it was going to be at around the 100K mark.
But she wasn't going to tell Terrence that.
The amount can seem pretty huge so that, you know, I don't want it to necessarily be, like, intimidating to anybody, you know, because I was in more debt than, you know, a lot of people make in a year.
And Terrence wasn't going to ask her how much.
I knew she had debt. I knew she had a good amount of debt. I did not know the exact dollar amount.
And did you ever think to ask her?
No, I really didn't. I didn't want to touch a topic that might be very sensitive for somebody.
Because talking about money is weird. It's one of our cultural taboos. But maybe the first step to starting those conversations is just learning the same vocabulary. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace's new podcast, This Is Uncomfortable.
You can hear the whole episode, or another one, about crying at work. Nearly half of American workers say they've cried on the job. Subscribe to This Is Uncomfortable, a podcast about life and how money messes with it. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. There's an experiment happening on a tiny island off the coast of Portugal, and it could shake up the worldwide energy market. Porto Santo, a Portuguese island with a population of only 5,500 people, is using the batteries in electric cars as a backup to the island's electricity grid. The cars top up their batteries from solar power when the sun's shining, then sell that electricity back to the island grid for use at night to power people's homes. Some experts predict this form of energy storage will become a global trend. From Porto Santo, here's the BBC's energy and environment analyst Roger Harabin.
Like many small islands, Porto Santo relies on imported energy. It comes in the form of diesel and fuel oil. It's dirty and polluting, and it's expensive. The local government would like to get rid of it.
Porto Santo is aiming to become the first world's fossil-free island, and it is important to continually involve the community, create awareness and make them understand that we are just starting a big thing that is going to bring huge changes to our island.
That's a promo video from local government. Their big thing is a radical plan to switch away from diesel-powered generation and onto wind and solar energy. The key question is how to secure that energy at night time when there's no wind or sun. The answer is this electric car. It looks like a standard model filling up its battery when the sun is shining. But there's a crucial innovation here. This car's battery can work in reverse when the sun goes down and give energy back to the grid to power people's homes. Here's Eric Funtum from the car's maker, Renault.
Everybody is using his car 10, 15, 20% of the time for driving, and the rest of the time your car is standing somewhere, and the car is somehow a battery which is standing next to the electricity grid. The idea of the project in Porto Santo Island is to use the car as a storage when it's standing to help the electricity grid manage a lot of renewable energy.
The battery cars will be smart, so they'll know just how much electricity they can afford to sell while still leaving enough for the morning drive to work. To help persuade drivers on what passes for Porto Santo's busiest road to join the electron revolution, the local government will offer subsidies to make electric cars compare on price with petrol and diesel vehicles. Veronica Brandmeier from Mobility House, that's the company behind the reversible chargers, says people need to calculate the hidden benefits too.
So what we're doing here is really exciting, because normally you would think if you own a car, it costs you a fortune, it costs you a lot of money. If you have a car that can feed energy back into the grid, you can actually earn money during the time it's parked. If there's no renewable energy available, you can feed it back and you earn money. So it really changes the whole idea of owning a car.
The local government needs half the cars on the island to be battery-powered to guarantee enough storage for an adequate backup to renewables. The electric revolution will reach into homes and workplaces. In the kitchen of the island golf club, the chef Daniel is cooking on gas. Before long, he'll be frying on electrons that have been carted round the island in somebody's car battery. A bizarre idea, perhaps. But some experts think that sooner or later, the rest of the world will follow.
That's the BBC's Roger Harabin. And this final note on the way out, Joey Chestnut preserved his title as champion of the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest today. He notched his 12th win by eating 71 hot dogs in 10 minutes. Maybe not great news for his health, but pretty awesome for the hot dog business. CNBC points out it's a rare moment for hot dogs to shine in a consumer landscape that's shifting away from processed food. Americans still eat almost 6 billion hot dogs every year, according to research firm NPD, but overall sales are kind of stagnant. So the hot dog eating contest, broadcast on ESPN, is pretty good PR for the industry. Of course, there are those who will serve hot dogs today just by default. In my case, because my mom told me to. Specifically, grill them until they are basically burn dogs rather than hot dogs. Got it, Mom. We've got to go. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekele, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke, and I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a good fourth. Kai's back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.